Hello, everyone. Can you hear me? Hello, can anyone hear me?
I can hear you.
Good, very good. And who am I speaking with?
Adam Orlando.
Oh, Adam, pleasure. Good, we're gonna, this is our first time, so we're adventuring into the world of Zoom here with everyone. Just wanna make sure it's all working properly. Good. Is anyone else here? Let's see who's there. Okay, everyone else there? Hello, everyone. Are we all here? Let's see, hello?
I'm in.
Okay, good. I'm unmuting everyone. Let's see, 1, 2, 3. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 folks. Good, okay, unmute all. The joy of technology, huh? So many options, I gotta make sure I pick the right one. Yeah. Maybe just gonna make sure I get my screen bigger, so. After everyone's in. Oh, okay, that's good. Wow, I don't have any pictures of you guys, just myself.
Oh, that is a blessing, Mark. Believe me.
That's a blessing, huh? Okay. Yeah. Okay. We got three more in the waiting room. Let's see who's there.
Okay. Good morning.
Hello, everyone. Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. This is our adventure. You get the prize for being up. What is it, like 3 o'clock over there or something?
No, 2 o'clock.
2 o'clock. Wow. I always put you at 6 hours ahead instead of five.
It's just called dedication.
This is it. You this is the instead of getting up to do your prayers till midnight to three, you get this on. This is great.
It was exactly. Anyway, it's good to be here, Mark. Good to meet you.
Well, it's great to have you guys all here. And just to give you an example of what's going to go on, I have you all unmuted. And, you know, we're going to go over some background before we get started because you'll get a little feedback from you. But I will mute everyone once we get started.
Right.
And then we're going to open up for question and answer. This is our first adventure with this platform. So everyone, please understand, your feedback is critical to me. If the camera angle is off, just let me know. Send me a text or even an email if you've got it, just to let me know. If there's any problems with the sound, the same thing, please let me know, okay?
My first adventure on this platform was one it was very easy to log into just with that number you gave me, so thank you for that.
It was easy to log into? Oh, good, very good. Yeah, see, because on my end, I've got all sorts of these options to pick from.
I know.
And fortunately, Mark DiCaprio, great guy down there in Florida, I was logged on, and he sent me a text saying, it's telling me that the whole thing is busy because just that. You know, I had to log off and log back on. Great. So let's see if we want. Let's do a quick go around here if you want. If anybody can introduce themselves and just tell us quickly where you're from.
James Brown from Montana.
Hello, James.
Hi there.
Mike Pascoe here from Glastonbury in the UK.
Hello. Adam Orlando from Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania.
He's just down the road from me.
James from Victoria, British Columbia.
Well, thank you, James. Travis?
Hi.
Anyone else?
Mark DiCaprio, down in Florida.
Hey, Mark.
Hi.
Hello? Devin Hess. Devin Hess from Bend, Oregon.
Oh, Devin, pleasure. Thank you so much for being able to make it.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun. One, two, three. I got nine folks here. I think that we're up to speed on the numbers. Let me just check our time. As I was saying, this is our first adventure into this, so please feel free to text me if anything needs to be brought to my attention regarding background, lighting, or any of that. I just think we're going to have a great 6 weeks, and what we'll do is we'll go for about an hour. Oh, there he is. Okay. One more. There's Andy. Andy, welcome. You made it.
Hello, hello.
We're just around, introducing ourselves quickly before everybody gets muted for the beginning of the show. Okay. Well, good. Well, what we'll do is we'll go for about an hour, hour 15. We'll take a short break because it is easy for you to break, but not for me. And then we'll come back. We'll finish up with about another 15 or 20 minutes. And then we'll open up at the end for about 20 to 30 minutes for question and answer. So each week we'll go for about an hour and a half to 2 hours. Remember, we're probably gonna hit that 2 hours very easy. Because there's so much to go over. But please, if you want, text me or email me. I think we have a text situation set up here on the platform. Text me your questions. I may be able to answer them as we go. Okay? Sound good?
Yep. That sounds great.
Oh, I got one more coming in. Okay, great. Okay, great. Sean, thank you for making it. Okay. And okay, guys, I think this is about it. And I'm going to mute everyone right now. Thank you very much. Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, and welcome to the first session of our 6 week course called Brauka, the Gateway to Classical, Medieval, and Renaissance Magic, or as we just shortened it to, the Gateway to Magic. It's really a pleasure to have all of you here. This is, as I said, our first adventure into this kind of platform learning, and it kind of is very ambitious of us because it is a 6 week class, and we're going to cover a lot of territory. So as we mentioned before we began, and we mentioned for those of you who may be joining us and catching this a little bit late, text us or email questions so that we can try and answer them during the course, but also at the end of each session, we will have a period for question and answer. Now, the question is, what is Brauka? And the word comes from German to try. And it is often associated with Pennsylvania German practices that are directly from the medieval period. And what's wonderful about it is that if you look at them very closely, you can see that they're clearly related to not only classical magic of earlier periods, but a wide variety of folk practices. Now, when we think of folk practices or folk magic in particular, almost everyone who's had anything to do with the occult on some level knows of someone, either knows someone personally or knows of someone, had an aunt, a grandmother, or a grandfather who could charm burns or warts or something. They were good at something. So we often think of folk magic in terms of the ability to heal, and that is a large part of it. So we're going to be talking a lot about healing and the role that it plays in folk magic. What we often do is we think of folk magic as something very simple, and it is. But that's probably its deceptive part, because it is simple, but not necessarily easy. So what we're going to do is look at folk magic not only in relationship to earlier magical practices, the classical, medieval, and Renaissance, how they relate and survive, but also we're going to be looking at in comparison to other folk practices, particularly Slavic magic, or also English cunning and hedge magic, and even where appropriate, some areas of Indian or Tibetan practices, because there is, of course, through the Silk Road, there was a tremendous amount of communication. Things traveled back and forth. We're also going to be focusing on principles. Okay, so take notes. We're going to be talking about what makes, or we believe to be, what makes magic or magical practices work. Because if I were to give you a class on just typical Brauka, or sometimes as it's called, powwow, the name is derived probably from connection or contact with Native American tribes in the Pennsylvania area. This would be a very short class. There's no question about it. I would teach you a few charms. You would practice them and off you go. And if you worked, fantastic. If they didn't work, well, that's just the way it is. Because part of what Brauka involves is, if, when you ask someone, what does it mean? It's a, they say it means to try. Meaning, as my great uncle used to say, you know, man proposes, but God disposes. So many of the Brauka practitioners, what they'll simply say, well, I'll try. They don't make any promises. I'll give it a shot. Because it probably can't do any harm, most of what these practices involve. So they would make an effort to help the patient or the client that would come to them. And what may be interesting to you is that within Pennsylvania, there was, I have yet to find a copy of it. I've heard of it, but I have not seen it. And if anyone cares to do some digging in the archives of Harrisburg or do some research, I would deeply appreciate it. There was actually some kind of licensing that would go on in the late 19th, early 20th century for Brauka, or powwow doctors, as they were often known. Because the powwow doctor was, in fact, very often one of the primary forms of healthcare. And if we look at folk magical practices, we see particularly something such as The Long Lost Friend, which is the principal magical text of Pennsylvania German folk magic, along with the 6th and 7th books of Moses. If we look at that text and others like it, we see that it is primarily concerned with healing human beings and animals. And because it's a very different world which these folks lived in. And it is a world which we have to begin to modify ourselves. That is our way of thinking, the way we're perceiving, a feeling about ourselves and others, so that we can get in touch with that magical worldview which they had. And that magical worldview was, of course, very closely connected to nature, because at that time, probably anywhere from 80 to 90% of the population lived in rural areas, unlike today. Most of us, we have no idea what a chicken looks like, let alone where it comes from. So we're going to be looking at magic in that context, but also you're very fortunate because, as I had said earlier, many magical practices were simply kind of standalone techniques that you might learn. And they would be taught father to daughter, mother to son, or some kind of cross-gender transmission. And you're probably sitting there thinking, well, okay, well, that's interesting, Mark, but how is that going to work for us? Well, one of the interesting things about folk magic is there's always a way around something. There's always a solution, okay? And with that solution, you could, in theory, teach an inanimate object. So when I would go see my great uncle, whom I lived next door to, and he would teach me, he would teach the table leg. And in teaching the table leg, I would be the one overhearing what the table leg was learning. So I have around me a variety of objects. I think I have some a wonderful statue of the goddess Maat. I have a wonderful statue of the Black Madonna of I think she's Notre Dame. And since these are feminine objects, oh, I also have, the goddess of the crossroads. She's there too. So we will pretend that I am teaching them and that, or at least we'll say attempting to teach them. And they in turn are listening, and that you are overhearing this conversation I am having with them. If not, you can find a similar object in your area, put it near you, and I will be teaching it, and you will be overhearing what is going on. Now, with that, as I said, this transmission, one of the things were very singular in nature. A charm here, a charm there. Rarely did you get a complete set of teachings. And by that, I mean something that was highly ceremonial. And for that, you would often see reference to the Faustian schools of magic, and in particular, the sixth and seventh books of Moses, of which my great-grandfather, who is buried not too far from here, I may take a picture of the tombstone and put it up for you. I have a picture of him if I dig one out. And he was said to be very skilled in that. And of course, there are stories of where he had learned this from as well that I'll tell you over the course of the next few weeks. With that being said, we have to look at Brauke contextually within the context of Pennsylvania German culture to the south, the southern part of the state that is around Philadelphia, Lancaster, Harrisburg, up into about Berwick, by the way, okay? That would be the farthest most edge, like Wallapin. Now, if you go to the cemetery there, there are some tombstones to the German traveling preachers who ran that circuit, and even up into Plymouth. So you would see a broader philosophical view. Behind me in the bookcase is a picture of Conrad Matthias, and he is part of the he was one of the last surviving members of Kelpius's group and the near the Wissahickon in Philadelphia. And he was described as being a fellow who, kind of a strange fellow even at that time, who would walk around in these long coats with a wide-brimmed hat and covered in talismans, and he was doing astrology. And even Christopher Witt, Dr. Witt, was doing astrology for folks at that time. So when we look at the culture, Brauke and folk magic form a popular survival of both pre-Christian and Christian magical practices and philosophies, some of which are kept whole and complete, but most of which, and I have to emphasize this, most of which are terribly fragmented. And fortunately, I didn't receive it in a fragmented way. I received it as part of a broader philosophical view of pietism and what we might think of as Rosicrucianism. So I'll make reference to Agrippa, Paracelsus, Bhma, Swedenborg, all of these fellows who would have been widely accepted within the broader esoteric view of that period in time. It doesn't necessarily mean that folks who practiced Brauke would have heard of all of them. Many of them would not. But when I was doing a lot of research in the late 80s and early 90s, traveling down to Carbon and Schuylkill County and interviewing folks and collecting additional information, it was not uncommon to find many of these folks did have a broader philosophical view. But they grew up in a working class environment. They grew up in an environment where practical effects of magic were more important than philosophical ideas. And that has to be stressed again, just as the nature of the practices were often very much about, can you heal my sick cow? Can you, bring weather? Can we stop the fire? And can we heal the broken bone? Okay. But there is also aspects of it that have to deal with visionary experiences, dream experiences, what we might think of as spiritualism or communication with the dead. And there are aspects that deal with, again, exorcism or getting rid of and dehexing. Dehexing is extremely popular because whenever you get into any of these cultures where magic plays a predominant role, it's about what but power. Magic is always about power. You need to write that down, okay? Mysticism may be about our deep, profound experience of unity with the divine or something like that, but magic is about power and its application, okay? And whenever you have one alpha male or alpha female in the town and you have someone else coming in, there's often room for conflict. So stories of witch battles do occur among Pennsylvania German folklore, just as they do in other places. Now, as we go through this course, as I said, we're going to focus on principles so that we can give you kind of a fundamental grammar of operative magic rather than formulas, so that you can have personal experiences and allow those experiences to guide you. Because as one fellow said to me a few weeks ago, and it was a wonderful phrase, he said, you know, generic rituals produce generic results. And there is some truth to that. And we start out with generic rituals, which is very good. It's a starting point, but we have to internalize it and make it our own. And that doesn't matter what system of magic you're using. It's, you have to make it part of yourself. Even if you were to be a complete and total devotee to some of the more modern Victorian systems, such as Arnold Solis or the Golden Dawn, or some of the modern witchcraft revival practices, you would still have to internalize it to the point where you and it are one and the same. But then so are the other practitioners too. They've internalized it too. Because the energies always move in and through us. Now please write that down. The energies always move in and through us. Okay. Some of the books which you'll be not really needing, but I really suggest that you get them for this class, is going to be Unfolding the Rose, okay? Powwow, Traditional Folk and Grimoire Magic, Ritual Purification, Exorcism and Defensive Magic. And you can find some of these YouTube programs online, or on YouTube, the recordings that we did of these programs when they were originally done. Those programs were done spontaneously, that is recording. So we didn't plan on it, we just kind of started doing them. Fortunately, I have someone who is going to be cleaning those recordings up and making them just wonderful for us. So there's going to be improvement in that area as well. But here's additional material that can help you in your understanding of folk magic. Powwow, Traditional Folk and Grimoire Magic, and also Pietism, Powwow, and the Magical Revival. I would encourage you to particularly get the last one because it is semi-autobiographical. It tells about my story and my connection to Powwow. And it'll give you a very good overview of its relationship to Rosicrucianism, Pietism, and these other philosophical views that then directly connect us back to the Renaissance. I also would suggest you get a copy of The Inner Way, The Power of Prayer and Belief in Spiritual Practice. There's a whole section in the back there on the use of Psalms, which we'll go over. And also Drawing Down the Life of Heaven, an introduction to Renaissance magic, because we talk about the magical worldview in there. Again, I would like you to get these, but they're not essential. We'll go over everything. Supplemental reading that I think you'll find is very useful. I'm sure you have these books too, or can get copies of them online in terms of ebooks, would be some of the writings by Willy Schroeder, his History of Energy Transference, his commentaries on the occult philosophy of Agrippa, and his Rosicrucian notebook are very good. A lot of that stuff in there you see in folk magic. Oddly enough, I also like to recommend Initiation into Hermetics by Franz Bardon, because while Bardon is a very rigid and almost dogmatic approach to using energies, you'll notice if you're doing any magic that it is a very effective system. And it's really would be part and parcel with what you see in a lot of folk practices. It would not be alien or foreign to it. you wouldn't necessarily find it there. I'm not saying you would, but it would not be rejected either, particularly since he's basing it off the Tetragrammaton, which appears a great deal in what we're going to talk about. So because this is an operative course, let us start with an oration. And you may say this with me. Okay. And or silently, whichever you prefer. Heavenly Father, creator and sustainer of all that is, was, and will be, we pray to you to bless us and our work of this day, that it may make us ever more clearly aware of your imminent presence, power, and wisdom. Send the Holy Spirit to awaken the divine fires within us, that your holy bride, Sophia, the perennial wisdom, will flower within us, and that we too shall shine like the rosy dawn of the new morning. Amen. Now, the magical psalm most commonly used in all practices is the 91st Psalm. And before we begin any work, not only do we seek to invoke divine aid and presence, but we also seek to create an environment that will be beneficial to us and others and conducive to the work we're about to undertake. So for this, we use the 91st Psalm, and I'm using the King James Version. You may use any version you like, and please feel free to say it with me. And to imagine it, don't just say the words, but allow your imagination to reach out, because your imagination is the focal point, the key to all realization. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress. My God, in him will I trust. Surely he shall deliver thee from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence. He shall cover thee with his feathers, and under his wings shalt thou trust. His truth shall be thy shield and buckler. Thou shalt not be afraid of the terror of the night, nor the arrow that flieth by day, nor the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor the destruction that wasteth at noonday. 1,000 shall fall at thy side, and 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee. Only with thine eyes shalt thou behold and see the reward of the wicked. Because thou hast made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High, thy habitation. Therefore, no evil shall befall thee, neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling. For he shall give his angels charge over thee, to keep thee in all thy ways. They shall bear thee up in their hands, lest thou dash thy foot against a stone. And thou shalt tread upon the lion and adder, the young lion and dragon shalt thou trample underfoot. Because he has set his love upon me, therefore I will deliver him. I will set him on high, because he has known my name. He shall call upon me, and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life I will satisfy him and show him my salvation. When we look at this prayer, and we should always visualize these prayers when we say them to really begin to understand what's going on, you notice the first part is what we are doing. You know, it's kind of a statement. You know, he who dwells in the shelter of the Most High. And then there's this, what happens, the benefits of such activity, such spiritual activity. And then there's a statement about what God does, okay, and what, you know, how God is reacting and acting towards us, what the benefits of that activity are. We don't think in terms of refuge. That's often an interesting word. The Lord is my refuge, you know, the secret place, my fortress. And this was because we live in a relatively safe society. Now, when these prayers were written, life was not safe. It was short, hard, cold, and brutal. And of course, the magical necessities reflected that, just as the magical necessities that we see today reflect our view. Most people aren't concerned about magic as a source of power. They're concerned as with magic or spirituality as a source of awakening or enlightenment, some kind of self-realization or psychological modality. Just because they're blessed, they're fortunate. They don't have to be concerned about where they're going to get their next meal from or someone coming over the hill to take it from them. So we have to think of this. What does it mean to have refuge? To take up a secure dwelling place mentally, emotionally, within our notion of deity. And what is this secret place? You know, some people can think of it as like the psychic centers, but it's really a state of focus, a state of awareness, a state of mind, and usually within the heart. Okay? The heart is always, not always, but often portrayed in that way as a fortress. Okay, it is a secure place. It can be hard to penetrate for us seeking to get into it, but once we're there, it's a secure place for us to realize our true nature, our true state of being, our relationship to divinity and to others. And that this relationship is, while it's very nice and comforting, it protects us, it also provides for us as well, and is an active component to it. You know, I will answer him and be with him in trouble. I will set him on high because he knows my name. We're going to get to that too. What is the nature of the name or the divine name, the divine names, particularly in magic? That has a lot to do with those working with the Psalms. I will show him my salvation. Salvation is a kind of a form of healing, wholeness. So within these practices, there's that notion of a completeness that will take place. So say this prayer early and often, and take your time and contemplate it and think about what it means. Visualize and imagine it and allow your own realizations to take place regarding it. And that's something that is really great about folk magic, is that because it's not laden with a great deal of academia, individual practitioners can almost become saintly when you look at the history because of their simplicity. You know, they perceived a truth and they taught that truth as they understood it within the context of tradition. And other people will later, you know, grab onto it and perpetuate it and have traditions. And often those truths might be rejected by the churches, the official churches at the time. Then you see later on they are grabbed onto and adopted. Kind of the irony there. And you see that a great deal, for example, in, say, Tibetan Buddhism. A lot of the practitioners were not terribly well educated. They were not part of the broader monastic system. We see a lot of folks actually leaving the monastic system to go practice out in the wilderness, out in the wilds. And with that, they develop a very unique understanding of the Dharma. And they then perpetuate that and teach that. So the same is possible here. That's something I'd like you to write down. Make a sign, in fact, and put it in your oratory. That is your sanctum, your place of worship or prayer. And put it where you can see it. Are these two words, patience and courage. Because you're going to need patience with this and you're going to need courage. And in fact, in your notebook, which we'll talk about shortly, you can put patience on the front inside cover and courage on the back inside cover as a reminder. Now, daring is often the word used, but I prefer courage. Because again, it's linked to the root word for the heart. Okay. So then, again, what is Brockway? Brockway comes from the word to use or need or to employ. As we said, it means to try to help, because man proposes, but God disposes. And along with it, we often hear the word hex or hexerai. Okay? Now, hexerai is an archaic word for witchcraft and is synonymous with hexen work and zabara. It is often associated with evil, but not always. And this is where the terms have very idiosyncratic meanings from one community and tradition to another. This is not unique. I remember having one lama tell me that he was writing a dictionary on different Tibetan terms because the meaning changes so much from just tradition to tradition. And you have so many different lineages that you just can't have those change. You know, you just can't use the words as interchangeably as we'd like to. You see the same thing in alchemy and Kabbalah, where the use of the word mercury may have three or four different meanings depending on how it's employed. Same with all of them. And then you run into the problems of Bhima, who has incredibly idiosyncratic terms. You have Paracelsus coining whole terms along with the rest of them. Of course, he gave us the term spagyrics, and the same thing with Agrippa as well. So the unique use of language is very important in each of these lineages and lines. As we said, from hex, we get witchcraft, or to curse, or wish bad luck on someone. From Zauber, we get his magic or enchantment. So Zauber is often seen in words such as Zauberung, or enchantment. Zauberspruch, or spell, or magical speaking. Zauberkraft, or magical power. Zaubermacht, magical power again. Zauberstab, or magical wand. And Winterzauber, or winter magic. I guess when you live in a very snowy place, it's good to have some weather magic on your hand. Now, within this framework, of course, as we said, traditions exist, and they are composed of teachers, teachings, and community of practitioners, which exist across multiple generations. In this instance, I am your teacher. I am giving you the teachings. You form the community of practitioners, and hopefully you will learn this, take it to heart, and be able to pass this on to at least one or two other people so they, in turn, can continue this. Just as I learned it from other people and have modified it to some degree, and I'll tell you where I have and where I haven't, you, in turn, will take your experiences and modify it to some degree. And just be honest with that when you teach it to others. What is your experience and what is what you have learned in that unbroken line, so to speak? So right now, many of you know, many who have practiced folk magic probably, often it's a part of the rural culture where there is not a lot of reading, not a lot of academia, often illiteracy. Historically, travel was extremely limited about what the average person could learn. Probably until about 1900, many people didn't travel much farther than 20 miles from their place of birth. Okay. As many people would concentrate in that one area, you would see one or two people, of course, arise that would have some sense of magic, as we said earlier, but not necessarily the whole picture. So if you go to the southern parts of Pennsylvania, as out to parts of Appalachia, West Virginia, in fact, many people think that the magical practices in West Virginia are of Scottish origin, and that's not completely true. There's some very good research that said, yes, they are to some degree, but there is extremely heavy German influence as well in some of those areas. That goes down also into the Carolinas and travels out in part to Ontario, and also into parts of Texas, okay? So wherever they went, they would bring their magic with them. Now, the most common books involved, as I said earlier, was the Bible, The Long Lost Friend, and the sixth and seventh books of Moses. Other grimoires existed, but these are the common ones. Within the sixth and seventh books of Moses, the Shem HaMafresh, or the permutations of the divine name of the Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the 72 names, would be the most common section used. And it wasn't often just the permutations of the names, but again, how different divine names were applied and used to the Psalms and how the Psalms would be used for magical practices. Okay. We would see the 6 and 7 books of Moses and the prayers in it become or reach outside the German community. We see it move into hoodoo practices. We see it move into some of the Cyprian practices. And we also see it move through the Caribbean, over to Africa, and back again. Okay. And within that context, if you were very fortunate and you knew someone who had a great deal of time on their hands, clearly, which meant they had to have a modest amount of wealth, these magical practices might be further elaborated and involve astrology, geomancy, herbal medicine, palm reading, dowsing. Okay, all of this falls within the framework. And card reading. Now, cards that were done were not tarot cards. Those are fairly modern as we understand them. This card writing might involve just regular playing cards or variations of other divination decks. In fact, as the weeks go by, I'll show you what was in the possession of my great aunts, and you can see them. Okay. So along with healing, people and animals, the biggest practice was dehexing. But within all of that, the professional scholar magician was fairly rare. And that's what I'm trying to give you the information to become, so that you can use this to be a scholar magician, not simply a technician. Focusing on principles so you can be an engineer and understand not only how things work, but how they're created as well, rather than just someone like myself who, when faced with some of these technical issues, it's, I need something that's plug and play. Take it out, put it in, take it out, put it in. Don't ask me any questions about how it works. Okay, just, I need it idiot proofed. Okay, I don't want you to be that way with your magic, particularly with regards to folk magic or these traditions. The thing that makes our magic work is our view, our philosophical worldview. And in the Renaissance, we would have called this the magical worldview. And the magical worldview can be summed up in how we understand, interpret, and experience ourselves in relationship to the universe, and the universe being all that is seen and unseen, all that it contains and expresses. It is our personal philosophy of deeply held beliefs that form the basis for all of our activities and our understanding of them. The Western magical worldview can be summed up in three sets of ideas. One is macrocosm and microcosm. There's correspondences and signatures. And then, of course, the notion of thought, word, and deed. Now, many of you have heard about the notion of macrocosm and microcosm, and the idea that each of us is a miniature universe. And there's many diagrams out there from the Neoplatonic period and onward that show, you know, the stars and the planets in each of us. And there's a wonderful set of illustrations, among the Behmenists, from one of Bhima's students, that show this as well. And it talks about the doctrine of the fall and then doctrine of regeneration and how things change within us. Despite that, and the tendency to think of these in terms of the notion of chakras, there isn't a really strongly developed sense of psychic centers in Western esotericism. Not to the same way it works in Indian or Tibetan Tantra. There is the correspondences and how the planets and those energies affect the physical organs or the aspects of the body, just as they affect the environment around us and other human beings and animals and plants and minerals. But the idea of psychic centers
is not a highly developed notion. The closest thing we have to that are the various meditations on the heart. Okay. So the notion of the microcosm, macrocosm in that regard is most important because it focuses around that hermetic axiom, as above, so below. And as above, so below, to accomplish the work of the one thing. Whatever that work is, depends on who you listen to, whether it's the formation of the stone or enlightenment. But the energies of the invisible and the visible world are related and united. And in fact, one of the translations of the Emerald Tablet that I like the most says, that which is above comes from that which is below, and that which is below comes from that which is above. So here the relationship is more dynamic. It's more integrated. It's more free-flowing rather than kind of creating this context of a mirror. You know, like you're just reflecting back and forth, because we hear a lot of that idea of reflection in some of the literature, but it's not a static reflection like you have in a mirror. Again, it's dynamic. Things are in motion. Okay. Then we have what Paracelsus says, and please write this down. The visible forms are expressions of invisible principles. Okay, so when I look at something, I have a form, but what that form is telling me is the nature of the energies which gave rise to that form. See, you and I, when we get into a car or a bus or another vehicle or ride a bike, we think of just getting into it, or like a clothes or something. We don't think of our energies as giving rise to that form, okay? But very often they do. Now, that doesn't mean that my energies actually created the car that I drive whole cloth out of thin air, just, you know, materialize it magically. But the type of car that I drive reflects certain inner values that I have that are then reflected in my life. And of course, that's why those of you who saw that wonderful movie, what was it, Apollo 13, about the astronauts who went into space, they all drive up in red sports cars. Well, of course, these guys are Air Force test pilots. They wanna fly a giant rocket into space and go to the moon. So what else are they gonna drive up on? I think one guy drove up on a motorcycle. But that reflects their inner energies. So you see that same notion then, and there's a feedback loop now. As above, so below, as below, so above. This creates a feedback loop. And we see that then reflected in notions of the art of placement. And Marsilio Ficino, in his three books of life, gives direction and instruction on the art of placement. There's some very good books on the Indian art of placement, which is a little more similar to our notions of the elements in cosmology, because of it, the astrology is more or less the same. And then, of course, you have Feng Shui, Chinese art of placement, and various schools of that. And of course, the idea is that there is a relationship between the physical form and the energies. And what we seek to do is understand what they are and use them to our benefit. Okay, so that can be anything like having this wonderful bookcase behind me and wearing a jacket instead of a t-shirt to the statue of Taw, off to my left. You know, all of these things are picked for a reason. You know, it's to create an environment, and not one that's just pleasing to you, because there are other areas in this room I could have pointed this camera that would give you a pleasing expression. But these objects and items around me also have an additional influence. So I want you to think about that and look about how you dress, why you dress the way you do, where you live, your environment, and then begin to look at other people as well and try and get a sense of what are the energies here? What is this telling me? Okay. Now with this is the notion that Every cell is a gateway to the infinite by way of its similitude to something else. Because everything is interconnected through this web, it doesn't really matter where I start. I can get where I want to go if I just have patience and courage. And how often in life haven't we just said that to someone? Just start already. Don't worry about it. Just start already. And just keep going. We'll get there. If you just pay attention and modify, listen, learn, and adapt along the way. Just do it. Okay? What is that we say? What's the phrase? Paralysis or overanalysis? And I'm sure each of you have experienced that in your own life. And you've seen it happen in others because people are just afraid to begin. But we have to, because once we get in the door, everything can open up to us. And you see a host of meditative methods that are focused on that. It really doesn't matter so much where you start, just as long as you do start. Because instead of looking at this like a pathway moving forward, okay, look at it more as a maybe a sphere or a wheel, okay? And the like on a bicycle wheel, you have all the rods that come in and support the from the outer rim to the center of the wheel that support it. And those individual pathways all lead to the same thing, to the center. It doesn't really matter where you start. And yet, when you're standing at one and you're looking at the other, it looks so far away. Right? How can that be anything like where I'm at? How can that know anything? But as you move closer to the center, they all get closer, 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 and you can understand those pathways easier and better. Because the further you go, the more you experience, the more you begin to know, and the easier it is to bring in these various diverse paths and experiences within yourself as well as in the world around you. Sympathy and contagion. These are core ideas within almost all folk practices. And that is like is known by like. That's the sympathy aspect. Like is known by like. We see that with doctrine of correspondences, right? Gold is like the sun. Sun is light and flame. And you know how this chain of connectivity goes. But that these energies are dynamic and alive, so that there is a contagion element to them. They can be transferred. Again, they're not static. They may be in a place, but they can move from that place. And they can be in an object, and someone can pick up that object and take it with them, and then things change. And of course, there's tremendous amount of wonderful ghost stories about this, right? I mean, the History Channel's ghost hunting network shows would be out of business if it weren't for more and more stories of someone who goes to the antique store, buys something, you know, takes it home, and next thing they know, you know, their books are stacking by themselves in the living room, or the, you know, chandelier is shaking, and you know, someone, they wake up and their kid is speaking in Latin backwards at 3 a.m. So all of those stories have to do with some degree of energetic contagion. Now, of course, those are the ones we hear about because they make the best stories, and they're also the most negative. People seem to gravitate towards those, but there's positive contagion as well too. And that's where we get into the notion of blessed objects or talismans or amulets, okay, where we can bless water and give it to someone, where we bless food and give it to someone, where the whole notion of the sacramental acts is a transformation of a blessing, an act of contagion, if you will, where something is charged and it is consumed, or we absorb it in some way and are transformed by it. So again, when we're looking at folk magic, you're almost always focusing more on that direct energetic experience rather than a lot of abstract intellectual principles. Now, things like Gematria and Notaricon, I've never run across them, okay? Excessive use of the doctrine of correspondences, you know, I've never run across it. Just what works. It's about what works, what gets me where I want to go. Okay. And of course, what is the doctrine of correspondences? It's a theory that natural objects, correspond to a particular or transcendent archetype, whatever those archetypes might be, that there is a connection to it. Okay, so this statue of Ta, this statue of Isis, you know, the statue next to it of Tahuti, that these aren't just abstract images, but in and through them, there is a real channel or connection that can either be established or enhanced that allows me to have an inner realization. Remember, back and forth, okay? A realization of the archetypal ideas they represent. And it's not just them, but it's the simple stone or crystal behind me or whatever other natural element you may have, such as, you know, rosemary. Rosemary is a solar herb. So it has tremendous solar benefits. So in and through that, we can not just have the medicinal qualities of rosemary experienced, but we can have the psycho-spiritual experiences as well. Doctrine of signatures is, of course, the belief that the medical and magical virtues of an herb may be found symbolized some way in the herb's shape, color, or other qualities. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. I always say use that one carefully. And then, of course, thought, word, and deed. Now, in Vajrayana, they talk about body, speech, and mind. This is because of a crossover of cultures, probably out of what is now what would have been Persia. And it was during the period of the Babylonian captivity that we often see the arisal of the Jewish notion of angelology and demonology and a lot of these notions. And within Zoroastrianism, you also see this constant reference to thought, word, and deed. You see that in the Judaism as well as in Christianity and many of the Christian liturgical practices. And we can think of it in terms of what is it that we are thinking, what is it that we are saying, and what is it that we are doing. And thought is those dominant ideas that we hold in mind. Speech is not just the words, but also the emotional energies, again, that are behind them. And then there's action. That's bringing things to fruition. Because what do we say? Talk is cheap, right? It's action that counts. So when we have our thought, word, and deed focused on a single goal, such as you would see in NLP, they call it congruity. We're focused. We're going in all of us is going in the same direction at the same time to achieve the same goal. When someone is not being congruent with themselves or with others, there's a form of deception or lying that's going on, or simply just neuroses. And we see this often when people say one thing and they do another. They say something, but we know they're thinking something else. I mean, whole sitcoms are based around this notion and in many social encounters. You know, can we really trust what they say? Can we trust what they do? You know, what do we know about that person for real? But with us, with ourselves, we're always asking, am I congruent? Now, what makes this interesting is that one person's congruency may not be another's. You know, that what makes one person very reliable and focused and dedicated, in some ways, may be a different set of values than someone else. But within themselves, they are, again, congruent. And in relationship to you, they are congruent. So that's another thing to look at across your day and across your life. Are my thoughts, my words, and my actions all lining up? And when you're having some level of conflict with someone, notice where is that conflict coming from? Is it because there's a break in their thought, word, and deed too? Are they congruent and lining up, or are they not? Okay. Because if you need to, and I use the word diagnose, if you will, problems with other people where you're attempting to magically intervene on some level, you need to really be able to identify what those energies are, and not only what those energies are, but then how they affect that person, where they create the break in congruity, the disruption, if you will. Now, Paracelsus directs us to observe, again, forms as being molded to express the inner essence of a thing, be it a plant, a stone, or a person. This is why I'm focusing so much on energies at this point. And, of course, this taking from Paracelsus, he says, "Behold the Ceterian root. Is it not formed like the male privy parts? Accordingly, magic discovered it and revealed that it can restore man's virility and passion. And then we have the thistle. Do not its leaves prickle like needles? There is no better herb against internal prickling. The Sigvert's root is wrapped in an envelope like armor. It gives protection against weapons. And the Siderica bears the image of a snake on each of its leaves, and thus it gives protection against any kind of poisoning. The chicory stands under a special influence of the sun. This is seen in its leaves while the sun is shining. As the sun sets, the power of the chicory dwindles. Each plant has a specific resonance that corresponds to one of the seven levels of duality." This is from Jean Dubuis. For instance, the caraway elixir, whose archetype is based on level 8, well, that would be Hod or Mercury of nature, could induce experiences of daydreams and develop inner powers that give authority over the elements. In magic, like in alchemy, therefore, through the choice of an appropriate plant, if it will be possible to act on a chosen level. I use that modern example because it's a little easier to understand that these plants that we use, again, don't just have a physical effect, they have a psychic effect, and that we can direct those psychic energies of the plant to have an awakening on a different inner level. So you'll see that's where a lot of the potions, this notion of creating potions for flying potions or different dreaming potions come about. Those tend to be more generalized. They're just designed to get you out of your body, quite literally. Whereas what we're talking about here is saying, okay, well, I'm going to go to sleep anyhow. I'm going to dream anyhow. Let's find a tincture or an elixir that is going to more gently help aid me move in that direction. And it's simply through a matter of correspondences that can be done quite easily. Okay. Now, these two doctrines, that of correspondences and its practical application in the doctrine of signatures, give rise to two principal forms of magic, that is natural magic and ceremonial or ritual magic. In natural magic, these forces are directly encountered. This is what I'm talking about, the direct encounter of these energies, sensing what is happening within you and around you and the people there, sensing what is coming from the plant, sensing what is coming from the room. Okay. So in natural magic, it's directly encountered, often unconsciously. Whereas in ritual magic, specific effort and context is created to manipulate these energies. Regardless, both of them must adhere to this Paracelsian doctrine, found in the classic literature, of treating limb to limb or like to like. Okay. In magic, this also involves the identification of our limbs with the limbs of divine beings or even God. Thus, we often see a sort of assumption of the God form taking place in many of the prayers. Think about that, limb to limb, like to like. Tonight is Thursday, it's ruled by Jupiter. Jupiter is often seen as the teacher or guru planet, okay? It rules philosophy, esotericism on a big level. That's why we picked it. It's a good night for this kind of teaching. Limb to limb. When we often see prayers, when we read them, notice that the individual is saying, identifying with the limb itself. My arms are your arms. Your ears are my ears. Your head is my head. We see that in the classical literature. And we'll often see that in the prayers in powwow when we get into them. You'll see them. So this is a form of identification, a form of what we like to use as a phrase, that modern phrase, assumption of the God form. We are identifying with those energies through a historical recitation of what has occurred. So in a sense, the rituals that we do in these practices are more subtle. That is, the invocation is not of some, often it is of external forces, but it's a repetition of a statement that because something is done, it has occurred, and I have those abilities, I am just like that. I am just like that. I can do it too. So we have cosmology as well, which is the beginning and the end, the Alpha and the Omega. This consists of four or five elements, depending on how we're looking at it. There is spirit. We often don't deal with this too much, but it's a notion of just space. That is everything which exists, okay? Everything which can exist. In Kabbalah, this is the Tzimtzum, or the contraction, found in Lurianic Kabbalah, wherein God, or the limitless light, contracts its energies to create a space wherein creation can take place. We reenact that every time we form a magic circle. We reenact that every time we enter into a state of meditative relaxation. There is the element of air, which is the finest of elements. Some place it first, others place it second. It is the vital energies of our being and consciousness. There is fire, the most dynamic of the elements. Again, some place it first. This is the power of transformation. Remember, nature renews all things by fire. So we use a lot of fire in Brauka because we're transforming things. Water, we use a lot of water too, which is the means or medium of transferring energy, purification and reflection. And then, of course, there's earth, the coldest of the elements, the most solid, and it is the foundation of occult practices because we're always looking for things to be realized, to manifest. These can form a pentagram, if you will, and it's most likely seen as that, as a pentagram in medieval and Renaissance magic. And those of you familiar with the Golden Dawn, of course, will have seen it, the variations of it. And the classical Greek version of the pentagram with the elements was labeled with the word for health. But as someone pointed out to me, that word means less health as we think of it, as it does mean a vigor, a wholeness, a divine completion, okay? Yeah. So we're looking at that sense of completion there. You know, instead of what we often see as the kind of defensive nature assigned to the pentagram. So think of the Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man when you think of the pentagram, that wholeness that it brings to it. Okay. So again, these are different notions. The pentagram, again, we see a lot of schools that they put the martial element to it. Yes, that's part of it, but that sense of wholeness, what would that be like? What is it like to be whole and complete in that regard? Then, of course, we have the seven ancient planets. These are the secondary causes. These are used extensively in Brauka, because of just same as you see an astrologer, planetary days. They have both active and passive, or dual natures, what we would think of as positive and negative. They are strong and weak. Every experience has its origin in the divine energies of these, and they're reflected and modified in some fashion by them. So they're constantly creating or reflecting the universal energies. We are constantly be absorbing them. Remember, as above, so below, as above, below, so above. The universe or the world around us is also reflecting them. And through this dynamic web of interacting energies, we are experiencing our life. And that's why someone said, you know, how much free will do we really have in this then, right? I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of activity. And most people are experiencing it unconsciously. How much free will do we really have? some would say if you're really, really good, maybe 60 to 80%. Because there's some things you just can't change. Said if you're good, maybe 50%. If you're average, maybe 25%. And just stop and think. Look at the people around you. Look at your own life. Look at how often your life was a function of habit. And then when did things really change? Okay. When were you able to actually exercise choice or focus or will? When were you congruent to achieve something and you moved in that direction? And then stuck with it till you achieved it. Now that would be a magical act, an act of will, an act of decisiveness. So how much free will do we really have in the world? Well, in some ways it's up to us. How much are we willing to observe ourselves, the world around us, and overcome our habituated limitations? That's really what it is. And this is really important because magic just adds, you know, juice to the fire. You know, it doesn't solve our problems for us. If anything, it will enhance them. It will aggravate them. Only to point out to us what we need to change about ourselves. That's why you often hear about different kinds of, you know, where magic backfires. We'll get into that later. But if you don't really grasp and understand that magic works in and through us, the energies work in and through us all the time, then you're not going to be prepared for the necessary preliminary actions of purification and reflection and careful choosing that magic often requires. And yeah, there are ways around that too, where we can have faith and trust in God and call upon saints and angels and things to help us. So there's a way around it. But we still have to recognize everything is in and through us, and we are the ones who must initiate that change and take responsibility for it. All of these planets, again, have reflections in our organs, okay? So hence the notion of limb to limb, both in the physical body down here and then another time in the head up here. You often see pictures of the zodiacal man with Aries at the head and Pisces at the feet and the different organs that they rule and then the planets. But we also see them, the planets, in terms of the effects that they have. You know, Saturn, of course, is the beginning and end, limit, slow moving. Jupiter is expansion, health and wealth and growth. Mars is energy, violence, physical strength and war. The Sun is status, fame, authority, courage, prestige. Venus is about love, romance, desire, domestic tranquility, art and beauty. Mercury, of course, is the intellect, speed, games of chance. And the moon, of course, is reflection, reproduction, dreams, and travel, often by water. So when we begin to undertake any activity, we can say, what are the energies of the day? Do our activities reflect those energies of the day? Because in different schools of Brauka, you would see, and you can see this in Old Farmer's Almanac. The days are listed. Planetary signs, zodiacal signs, and the activities that benefit that day. Okay, so this was widely done and widely even published, and still is in some of the literature. So those energies are there, and it's your responsibility to take advantage of them. It's your responsibility to recognize them and take advantage of it. Okay, these planets, of course, as we'll see, can be used singularly or in combinations, often with days and hours. You're aware of that. You don't see a lot of that in Brauka, but you do see the days, but not necessarily the planetary hours. I've seen charts where people use them for days, but not the hours. And of course, for different activities at hand. So now before we go any further, it's a little bit after 10. I'm going to suggest that we take maybe a little bit of a 5-minute break for those of you who may need it. I'm going to be online here, so if you have some questions, you can ask them to me, and we can bring them up. And then I'll talk for another maybe 20 minutes, and then we'll go into question and answer. Okay? Good. Now let's see. Yeah. Unmute. There you are. Everyone.
What was that quote? Paracels, the visible forms are expressions of what?
Let me find it for you.
Invisible impressions? Expressions?
Let's see. Visible forms are expressions of invisible principles.
Principles.
There was one book you mentioned on pietism. It's the only word I got.
Sure, yeah. Hold on. Let me get it for you. Pietism, Power on the Magical Revival.
Thank you.
Sure.
Is that the same one as the first powwow book you mentioned?
No. There are two of them. We did two of them. Okay. The other first one was Powwow, Traditional Folk and Grimoire Magic.
Okay.
Hold on 1 second. I'm just going to put this down, okay? I'll be right back in about 2 minutes, okay?
Yep.
But the speaker's on. Everything's recording.
Hi, about that? Crashing and banging.
Well, since this is recording, this is the time when we say a bunch of stuff that's embarrassing, right?
Right. Yeah, very good. Right, I have to use the bathroom.
How you doing, James? I haven't talked to you in a while. It's Mark.
I'm doing well. Good to hear from you.
Yep. Ugh. Thinking about calling you, but then I saw that 3 hours difference, and it's like,
Yeah. You always can. It can't hurt.
Okay.
You give me a ring anytime, man.
Okay, I'm back.
Anytime.
Yeah.
What?
Mark, is that piety paper in the back of the monograph on powwow?
Which paper?
It wasn't the piety and powwow. Is that the same one article by you that's in the back of the green powwow monograph?
Let me look. Straight Talk About Jacob Bimach, Template of Philosopher Stone, Power Psalms and German Magical Folklore. Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm looking at the back. I'm not sure which one. I see I'm looking at the suggested reading there. We had a lot of it. Yeah,
Mark, thank you for that. That was very, very, very interesting indeed.
Oh, good. Well, we're not over yet.
I know. And I'll probably just text you later just to clarify those books from your monograph series.
I'll be sending you guys emails. Don't worry about it.
Would you mind? I have a couple of them. I'm not sure I have all of them. So
yeah,
I have to move around this chaos is my office to find stuff. So yeah.
No, I got you. What's going to happen here, since this is the first time we're going through this, we'll clean it up and get you guys notes as we go and as we figure it out. And once the program is put together and we have like PowerPoint and stuff worked into it, because I did not want to overcomplicate this. Heaven forbid I push the wrong button here. And
technology smells fear. There's a couple of names here as well you referred to, which I wrote down phonetically. Willie Schroeder.
Oh, Willie Schroeder. Well, of course, the problem is it's German, so instead of an umlaut, it's an E. But,
right.
Yeah, Willie Schroeder is Yeah, I'm going to find it for you for the spelling.
Can you give me a text in bars, and of course I.
Yeah, it's S C H R O B.
S C H
R O.
Yep.
D T E R.
T E R.
Sometimes it's an O E because it's an umlaut, but it's Schroeder.
Yeah, no, sure. And what was his principal text?
Oh, he had three of them, which were actually quite interesting.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
Yeah, what is the history of energy transference, the commentary on the occult philosophy of Agrippa, and a Rosicrucian notebook.
Ooh.
Yeah, apparently he knew.
That's an interesting one on Agrippa.
Yeah, apparently he knew the German, you know, the German occult folks of the, you know, up until the 30s.
Yeah,
he had some relationship connection to them. And he's a lot of folk magic. A lot of stuff he's dealing with is in the folk milieu. So
interesting. Yeah. Thank you. That name hadn't come across. I will look that up, Mark. Thank you.
Oh, there. It's Wiser, by the way. Wiser Publishing.
Okay, it's great.
Okay, I have a chat here. Let me. Hopefully, I'll open it and we'll see where that goes.
Oh, it's a link. Nice.
Oh, good. Yes, thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
There it is.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, James. Oh, and very quickly, Mark, Psalm 91.
Yes.
Obviously, opening each ritual practice or meditative practice, but do you consider that on doing this on a daily basis as well, morning and evening? Or?
Yes. Yes. Because you want to really spend time with it and contemplate it. You know, not just make it a rote practice, but really consider what the ideas this is putting forth for you.
I think about it. That's great. Thank you.
Yeah.
And that's the 91st Psalm?
Correct.
Yes.
In the Protestant version. How does it go Catholic? It shifts one numeric order.
Yes.
One numeral.
Yes. Nice.
I don't know which direction it shifts in, whether it's 90th or 92nd. Yeah. I'm going to take one earbud out. Just
we like the King James language.
Okay. Now let me finish up some of the cosmology here. Is everyone back?
Yep.
Yes.
Everyone's in? Okay.
Okay.
Like I said, we've got a lot of material to go through. I'm sorry we have to kind of plow through it like this. And in fact, if you saw what I wanted you to do for the first week, I'm surprised I've gotten through half of it. But my guess is that all of you, and I'm going to mute you guys now, okay? I'm going to mute everyone for a few minutes, and then we'll get back to more question and answer, okay? Good. Okay. Okay, well, thank you for everyone for coming back from break. And we're just going to finish up some of the introductory material here on cosmology, because that has been what we're talking about, cosmology. We all have one, whether we think about it or not, whether we recognize it by that big word or not. We all have a notion of the universe, how it functions, and our place in it. Everyone does. And because that is how we direct our lives. And it's very interesting to talk to people about their view of life, their cosmology, as you will. And some people never give any thought to metaphysical views, ever. And some think about them all the time, probably too much. Okay, what we're trying to do is find not only cosmologies that are effective for us, because all cosmologies work. Well, we should say all cosmologies work. Whether they work well for us and we like the benefits or not is another story. But we want to increasingly have our understanding of life and our experiences in it match reality as it is. That's why we can often talk about there's reality as it is, or actuality, if you want to call it that, and our understanding of it. And we want our understanding of it to be clearer and clearer and clearer so that they match, so that there's no difference, so that we are, in that sense, enlightened or illuminated. We see reality, we experience reality as it is. Okay. So one of the ways we move forward in this is in understanding these invisible energies is the horoscopes through astrology, the 12 signs. Natal charts were widely practiced at different times in the colonial and American history. Please understand that. You know, when I was doing research for my book on Freemasonry, I was really surprised that I came across, let's see if I can see the book there. It is on, I may have moved it. I'll find it for next week. It was written by a Mormon. Well, he was actually cast out of the church, a historian on Mormon history. And the first half of the book was just this stunning review of occult cosmology and its role in colonial America into the 19th century. Okay. And I believe he mentioned in that book, a traveling book salesman in the South. Now we often think of the rural South. Okay. We often think of the notions that we often have through the media and how really truly wrong they are about so many things. In 1 year, he sold in, I believe it was like 1810 or 12, $20,000 in books. Think of a stunning amount of money that would be. That's almost unbelievable. Okay. So just as we have the New Age movement, which is kind of our modern folklore, really, in many ways, you had at all times, people have had an almost insatiable desire for what we think of as esoteric or occult knowledge. All of them. And David Metcalf, who some of you may have heard me reference, has some, just look him up, David Metcalf, he's got some great articles online. He does some phenomenal research on 20th century pop culture or occulture. And I love that stuff. I love to see what was in the old magazines and the backs of comic books. You know what I'm talking about. You guys love this stuff. This is what got so many of us into it. Okay. And getting the old Wiser catalogs, having to order stuff and wait 6 weeks for it to be delivered, you know, pre-Amazon and all of that. All of this formed an occult view. The idea that there's something out there, I can know it, and I can get it somehow to work for my benefit. And that's what it's all about. From the earliest shamanic experiences till now, we're all after the same things. And not maybe the same thing, but with the same group of things. And it has to do with understanding the relationship between the visible and the invisible, but cause and effect. And how these happen in cycles and in waves, and how we can ride that wave. And astrology is the tool that helps us do that. So we had astrological charts being done throughout the colonial period. I mentioned Christopher Witt, Dr. Witt, as being one of them, fellows who did this. We also have lunar signs for planting. Lunar signs are used widely in folk magic. I'm going to give you a fairly good list of uses of them as we go across the course. So don't worry about that. I'll get that information to you as well. And knowing how to say, well, what sign is the moon in? But also, is the moon essentially two phases? Is it growing or is it declining? And if it's growing, how do I use it to increase? If it's declining, how do I use it for decrease? There's also a period of the dark of the moon, which most occultists will avoid, but there's a very profound activity, which I was taught that you can do during that period that can open you up to a lot of very important experiences for your personal growth. If you're willing to, you know, take on that courage. And I really encourage you to. So we see a lot of diagrams, and I'll find some pictures for you, but you can't find them online, of the zodiacal man and you know, how all of these planets and energies are pictured in the human being. We don't see the tree of life much. We really don't. And 6 and 7 books of Moses, remember, because now we're moving into Faustian and Grimoire magic. That's different. When we're moving into the Key of Solomon, which was, they found a copy of this was at Ephrata, German cloister in Pennsylvania, an effort of the Pietist cloister, where the Eckerling brothers practiced alchemy, and where they had a planetary observatory. You do see some of it there, but again, it's not all over the place. It's not like it is now, not like we see it in magic now. So you can incorporate that if you want to, or you can incorporate some of the older Neoplatonic diagrams, you know, the various circles or spheres, and that would be in connection with it. If you want to see some good diagrams, look at the secret symbols of the Rosicrucians of the 16th and 17th century. There is a German book online which you can find that has it. We'll see if we can get you a link to it. You'll see what I'm talking about. And in our opening prayer, you notice we mentioned Sophia, because Buma mentioned Sophia. And in the secret symbols of the Rosicrucians, Sophia plays an important part. Okay, so while others might ignore that, I'm bringing this to your attention so that you can incorporate it into your practice and see how this connects back to older Gnostic and pre-Christian ideas. Okay, and that we can vivify our practice through that. In fact, when I took my copy of the and I'll bring it so you can see it. I took my copy of the secret symbols and I compared different versions of it. And I then colored in almost all of the plates by hand. I have a few more plates to go. It's taking me many years because it's an off and on project, but I do look forward to its completion because it's one of the few copies in existence that is hand colored. Okay. Manly P. Hall, by the way, the Philosophical Research Society did publish a French-German or a French edition of Secret Symbols, and we'll talk about that. Okay, astrology and cycles. So solar energies are for the day, lunar energies for the night. Lunar energies are often ignored, but they need to be really absorbed in magic. My great-grandfather, Augustus Tischler, was often, berated, but my grandmother says how her mother used to refer to him as a moon worshiper because he was always outside staring at the moon. And then, you know, her brother told me what was being done, and it was a meditative practice very similar to what was described in the book Lighting the Eyes of the Dragon by Baolin Wu. Baolin Wu was a Taoist priest who was able to escape the Cultural Revolution. That book, Lighting the Eyes of the Dragon, is an exceptional piece of work. And again, if you look at the simplicity of the practices, they're very much a folk practice where things are very internalized. It's very much a matter of you doing them. If someone told me that their grandmother was doing something like this, I wouldn't be surprised. Because these are people's direct experience with energies in nature. Okay, that's really important to understand. That's always what we're going for here. So you might undertake this lunar practice in there, but you're going to internalize it. You're going to make it your own. And you're going to share that and you're going to incorporate that. Okay. And with that is the notion of dreams. And on the dreams, there are prayers and uses of psalms to invoke dreams. Dreams and revelation are very important because that's how you have communication with the invisible in your dream state. It is in this dream state that you can also have initiation. And this is where the symbol of the hag, the old woman, the old witch, and also the red witch can occur. And within that framework, the only other place I've really had anyone describe that to me was Dubuis, Jean Dubuis, in his writings, where he talks about the priestess in orange. And sometimes that orange or ochre color is often done as a reddish color in some paintings, in the Greco-Roman paintings. So this notion of the female force of initiation is right there with that whole notion of the Dakini in Vajrayana, but also the notion of the witch as Dakini in Indian Tantra, And the older woman, the hag, is of the witch or the fearful initiatic force that you see in some of the more wrathful deities as well. And I bring this up because if you're lucky, and I really hope you have this experience, I really do, you will encounter these beings. You will encounter these forces. And you will be changed forever. There's no question about it. So I really hope and pray for each of you that you have this experience, these experiences. The colors most commonly associated, of course, in these experiences are red, white, and black. And those of you who have studied alchemy will be clearly familiar with why that is. So we have again, see what time it is, the notion of thought, word, and deed, that we are in the world of action. The physical world is the world of action. In Kabbalah, it's Azeya, which is action. Remember, karma or kam is action. And we would say that here, and I'll quote Dubuis again because I like this. Nature has a single purpose. The evolution of life, the world soul of or materia, the prima materia of the ancients. This is done through a unique process, which is that of life, death, and rebirth, which the initiatic experience is. It's a process of life, death, and rebirth, accompanied by purification or steps or rearrangements of the elements of things and beings. The operative part is devoted to this aspect. Since the alchemical process is primarily to change the levels of the energies of life, it is obvious that chemical techniques alone are insufficient. Acting on life belongs to the field of art, the royal art, which requires an inner quality that the alchemist student must acquire gradually if he's to go through the stages of the hermetic path. As Paracelsus said, no one transmutes matter if he has not transmuted himself. Now, we can say the same about magic, and the magic seeks to change the qualities of life or energy, and the magus or adept must be able to temporarily at least change his or her level of awareness, and this is done through ritual purification, and with that, an understanding of the cycles of life, death, and rebirth. So fasting, prayer, confession, and alms, these four things, fasting, prayer, confession, and alms are the cornerstones of what we do. This fourfold process is particularly important for very significant rituals, both in the operator and those being done for others and even on Holy Week, okay? Now, in that rearrangement of energies, when you encounter these invisible beings, you will often have the experience of something being placed inside of you or taken out of you. And it is often incredibly painful. Sometimes it's incredibly pleasurable, but often it's painful, more often than that. And you wake up and it hurts, okay? That's how you know it's real. There's sufficient literature on this that you can read about in terms of different shamanic experiences. But to really have an experience it's a different ballgame. So if you do happen to have these experiences, I encourage you to talk to no one about it, but you can talk to me if you need to. But just don't go around talking about your inner experiences to people. It weakens them, okay? I will refer to things to you generally for a general context so that you can know you're not crazy, or at least not as crazy as you thought. But I will not give you specific details. One is because I want you to have your own experience, but also because the particular details that I have may not be of any importance to you. But the generalities are. That's why I'm trying to talk to you about principles, not formula. Okay. This is treating this really as a graduate kind of level course on magic. Now, for those of you who would like to learn more about purification, there's meditation and Kabbalah for health and wellness that we'll do. There's lunar and solar various meditations for purification. And always remember this. This is the key to all magic. How we see ourselves is how the invisible sees us. So write that down. How we see ourselves is how the invisible sees us. So as we're transforming We're constantly transforming our self-concept and our self-image and doing it in a manner where there is a tangible feedback loop between ourselves and our environment. And that would mean other people, but also the physical environment as well. Because the energies move in and through us. As a microcosm or small universe that reflects the energies of the macrocosm or the larger universe, this cannot be overstated enough. Okay. So let us think about this term reflects. Like a mirror, you reflect the light and its attendant wisdom and matter, like a light the mirror reflects the light which is shown upon. We can direct the light of this reflection like a lighthouse, or we can allow it to bounce off us randomly. In magic, we choose the former. Okay? That is why various astrological timings are considered and important. However, even when astrology is not a consideration, the energies will still move in and through us as conduits from the invisible to the visible or from unity to duality. So it's always happening, always, always constantly. So I want you to think about what we've talked about in terms of purification. Think about the notion of these energies, okay, in terms of your chart. If you haven't had one done, I suggest that you do. It can be very useful for helping understand yourself and in your situation, but also begin to create your notebook as you will, okay? So if you don't have a notebook, please get one. We'll just refer to this generally as a book of methods rather than something fancy like a grimoire or a book of shadows, although you can if you like. And then next week, what we'll go over is the notion of Eros or the power of Eros. And we'll begin talking about the different tools that you need, your Brauka bag, prayer cloths, protection cords, how to make them, the different kinds of knives, the handles, the white knife, the black knife, crossroad markers and all sorts of the good physical stuff. Because again, we're going to start with the tools we need and how to make the boundaries so we can establish the sphere that we are working in. Okay? So that's what we're going to get to next week. Okay? Well, good. I'm going to unmute everyone and we're going to go into some question and answers. Okay. Yes. Okay, how is everyone?
That's brilliant, Mark. Thank you very much indeed. A lot to think about. And if you could give us a reading list, there's some names there I didn't catch. Dubois or...
Well, what I'll do for you guys is I will actually send you the course material that I have here. I mean, I have 30 pages of detailed notes for this.
That'd
class.
Be great.
And you're going to get that. I'm going to send that out to you.
Oh, and the book you're referring to earlier is called Early Mormonism and the Magical Worldview.
Yeah, that was great.
Which is incredibly good, great book, by the way.
I had the good fortune to speak with him for maybe an hour or so when I was doing research, and he was just very helpful and informative. Just
but I say well worth the Italian job. Thank you.
So questions? Anybody, just feel free to go. Devin. Nope, I got you. I'm just looking at what pops up when I hear a noise. See, when you guys make noise, my screen lights up on your name.
And you said prayer, confession, and purification?
Yes, fasting, prayer, confession, and alms. These constitute our method of purification. My great-grandfather used to fast before taking communion. That's old school, I guess old German school. Yes. And, you know, there's prayer and confession. Confession is really very important. People don't, you know, we joke about a lot of things, you know, on social media. And, you know, a lot of the jokes are about... you know, what happens to the husband when he wins the argument with his wife, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or how ironic it is or rare that the wife may apologize for something. And this is really important, because when we look at our relationships with people, our ability to say I'm sorry and mean it and actually know what you're sorry for is really important, because it's reflection. The psychological act of confession is extremely important and valuable. That's why you see in the 12-step movement why the public storytelling. I mean, as long as it doesn't become a drunkalogue. I mean, we've seen that. But the ability to stand up and say, you know, it's okay. This is me. This is what I do with my life, and I don't want to do it anymore. And you know, I don't want to do it anymore. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Got you. Got you.
I've got a question, Mark.
Sure.
Earlier you mentioned the practical use of magic in relation to more of the mystical understanding of it. And I was curious, in the modern world, some of the conflicts that might arise of the practical use of magic versus just simply the mystical or an academic understanding of it, all in theory per se. And then when you actually go out into the world to use it, and some of the conflicts that might arise from that, and just being cautious of things like that.
Well, I think we can look at it. I'm going to answer it this way, and hopefully this will cover the ground that you're thinking of. Within the modern occult communities, specifically the magical communities, you have two views that are at loggerheads, because they're both right and they're both wrong. And one is that, and of course, my good friend, Dr. Joseph Leshefsky, was a spear point on this. What is traditional grimoire magic? Now, what is the old school way of doing things? And, you know, the old school magic was part of a culture, part of a context of the greater, mostly Roman Catholic culture of the period. So, you see in the grimoire, you know, go to confession, prayer, and all this stuff. You see John Dee talking about prayer. I mean, there isn't a lot of psychological notions going on. Their notion of what composed a human being was in some ways not as complex as ours. Okay? Our complexity comes out of the late 19th century, not only with psychology and psychiatry, but also with the inclusion of mostly Indian philosophies, Eastern philosophies, where, you know, you have the four ideas of functions of mind being discussed. So you see that happening, and that comes through New Thought, by the way. And we'll talk about New Thought in relationship to Brouka. You know, that's mostly New Thought. I mean, New Thought in a lot of this is essentially a version of Indian philosophy. It's very effective, and, you know, it's very direct. It's like much of it's like Raja Yoga. You know, it's direct experience. So you have this notion of magic as an operative force. So evocation, evoking elementals or demons, or what are these angels, you know, like Heptameron. And that's all it's about, and it's about force. And if I can get it to work, I get it to work. And it doesn't matter what kind of a person I am. Doesn't matter at all. So, and I think that's not completely true, otherwise they went through the preliminary requirements. Now, that being said, then in the modern view, there's a lot of emphasis on personal realization, personal expression, these Eastern philosophical ideas of what is enlightenment and awakening direct a lot of our notions of magic. What is illumination? What is this spiritual awakening that these Behmenists had, or Swedenborg, and all this kind of stuff? And they're seen as in conflict with one another, but they're really not, because the energies work in and through you. So the more integrated you are, the easier it is to deal with these other forceful energies. But if you're not integrated, then you just end up like a Faustian tale. So, you know, without naming names, because I don't want to get into any spitting matches with people unintentionally, you know, you can go down that road all you want. I mean, God bless you, but it's really best if you try to just take care of your own stuff first, and then these energies will more easily flow in and through you. You know, several of the folks in this class, you know, we've talked privately about that and independently about, you know, what are the big obstacles? So if you have friend Dubuis was very clear about this, and he said, you know, clear out the channels, clear out the relationship. And that's my view too. That's always been my view, and he's been as a child. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're having problems with X, you know, go right to that source, go to that planetary energy or that Sephiroth, and begin to work on that so that clears out and those energies flow more freely. The problem is when you do that, you suddenly realize that there's more than one problem. You know, and people want to sidestep that. They want to, they too often they come to magic because they don't want to do the work, and then they realize that magic is a lot of work. So purification, you know, fasting, prayer, confession, alms, these are very important because it creates discipline, focus, and generosity. The alms part is important.
Mark, we're talking about a worldview, a particular worldview. What happens when you're working for people, healing with people who don't subscribe that worldview? Does that cause a problem?
Well, yeah, it does cause a problem to some degree. But remember, if you're working within your own microcosm, so to speak, your own world, the energies are in and through you. We deal every day with people who don't subscribe to our worldview.
Yeah,
even when you're in a group, not everyone has the same understanding.
Got you. Thank you.
And I
got
to tell you, who said it? Who is the one who said it? I know it was. It was the tantric fellow from Svoboda. You know, you can ignore reality, but reality is not going to ignore you.
Yeah, okay.
You know, Saturn is going to come home. So that's why certain practices, you deal with Saturn. And that's why I'm going to talk to you about some Dark of the Moon practices. So you can go sit in Saturn's lap, and as much as you're not going to like it probably, begin to realize better now than later.
Yeah.
Let's just get this out of the way. Because after a while, you develop a relationship. You learn how to deal with it.
Yeah.
And Saturn.
Down with you.
Yeah. It's like these very powerful forces that we think of as demonic or wrathful, or whatever you want to call them now. You know, they can be very useful to
transformative.
You. Yeah. If you have the right relationship.
Right approach. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Anyone else?
You were saying that alms are very important. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, you know, you can't buy your way into heaven, but you certainly can buy your way out of hell. And, you know, many a mobster has tried to do that on their deathbed. You know, they try to do something good with the suffering you've caused. So... And that's pretty much it. You can't buy your way into heaven, but you can buy your way out of hell. And we have an obligation to use our resources for our becoming. But we don't live in an island. You know, we live in relationship to other people. So how do we use our resources to help others? Yeah, and you have to pick what that's going to be. You have to reflect and choose. That's why, I say, Jesus said, you know, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. Well, that's a pretty broad statement. That's open to a lot of very personal interpretation. You know, I've watched Tibetan lamas talk about bodhicitta, bodhicitta, bodhicitta. And never give to a beggar.
Right.
And I've walked by many a beggar. And I've told them two blocks down the street is the soup kitchen. They don't want to go. I've had other fellows knocking on a door. I was with a friend of mine. We were in his church cleaning it up for holidays. Mm. It's a beautiful Orthodox church. So I help him out on occasion. And it's cold. I mean, it's wintertime. The guy's banging on the door. And we took him in and we gave him, you know, food and stuff, and we pointed him in the direction because it was only a 4-block walk. It wasn't terrible. You know, and it wasn't dark yet, to the where he could get a soup kitchen and a room. You know, but the difference is you have to learn to, when we are generous and we give alms, we have to give alms. We have to be willing to, in whatever way that is. For me, that has been sponsoring lots of workshops over the years. And for one or two of the people on this list who've been very generous in helping make these workshops happen, or even this class, okay? That's one way of doing it, because we're helping those who have shown the desire and the willingness to want to help themselves, okay? Rather than just taking the Johnny Appleseed approach and just, you know, throwing things wildly. But you, on the other hand, you may be able to say, well, I don't really know what to do, so I'll just, whatever comes in front of me, I'll take care of. But you know, you have to be careful there, because you can bleed yourself dry doing that. I mean, there is a notion of the Good Samaritan. You know, the Good Samaritan did not go looking for someone to help, but whoever he came across this fellow on his travels, and he helped him, and he did what he could. He did the best for him, and then he moved on. You know? And then there's the story of Jesus. You know, Jesus didn't feed people. You know, what he did is he gave him a sermon, and then one of his disciples said, hey, they're hungry, and then he fed them. And I jokingly tell folks, you know, that's what happens when you go to the Salvation Army soup kitchen. You got to put up with the sermon first. So I'd rather go down to the Hare Krishnas, because they've got better food, you know. It's spectacular food, by the way. but so you know, even in the Flamel, you know, the Flamel's house, you know, where it was to help the poor, you know, the obligation was you would have to say a prayer. I was giving a seminar, probably 6 years ago now, maybe five or six. It was great. It was a Sunday. We were in a library, in fact, that was closed. And one of the fellows, a fellow comes banging on the door. And we let him in, and he needs some help, and we talk it over. And I said, okay, we'll give you the money you need, but here's what you need to do. One is you need to stop smoking, because it's expensive and it'll kill you. And two, for the next 3 weeks, you need to say a prayer every night for everyone in this that has helped you. And he was shocked. Okay, he was kind of taken back a little bit by it. You want me to what? And the smoking part wasn't a big deal. He probably wasn't going to do it. But, you know, it was. I said, you have to say a prayer for everyone that's helped you for the next 3 weeks, every night. You understand the nature of it.
Yeah.
See, because nothing in the universe is free.
I think it's generally a good idea anyway, to be honest with you.
Well, it is, but it's helping people understand their relationships, but also cause and effect. You know, what is the relationship? That's what we're always looking at. What is the relationship
exactly.
And cause and effect? Anyone else? Any other questions?
I have one, Mark.
Yes, please, Sean.
You mentioned about doing a chart for your astrology.
Yeah.
Do you know anybody who does that, or?
I do them. You know, I do charts, so that's not a problem. You contact me by email, and I'll send you the price list for them.
Okay. Sounds good.
Sure. Anyone else? Great.
That's great. That's very, very good, Mark. A lot to think about there.
Oh, we've got a ton, by the way. There's so much more. I mean, next week we're going to go over the power of Eros. We're going to look at that, because that's critical. And then, of course, making prayer cloths, protection cords, the felt mojo bags. I call them mojo, but they're called a Brauka bag.
Yeah, Brauka bag.
Those are great, because there's a special way you make those that's different from what you normally see. And cool. I remember these little guys. I was in a diner. I'll tell you about it next week. But, you know, it's great seeing this stuff, you know, for real. But this is it. This is the class. I really appreciate everyone being here. What I'd like you to do is to please, I'm going to just click on this chat because I see there's something else up there. Okay, I see some questions here on the chat. Let me answer those. Please send me some emails, making sure that you've heard everything properly about background noise or any of that stuff, so we can address them in future sessions. Now, D-Clan, what was the collective names of the four things? Fasting, prayer. Okay, that's just purification. That's all. A lot of these things don't have a name. Unfortunately, it's not like a lot of well-organized systems where we have a grouping title for it. But fasting, prayer, confession, alms, that's the preparatory essential purification practices. Okay, yes. And then what else? Okay, there we have it. That's good. Okay. Hey, everyone, thank you so much. This has been great.
Thank you, Mark. It's now 4 o'clock in the morning in the UK. I'm going back to bed.
Great. And
remember, thanks for joining us. Week.
Same bat time, same bat channel. Good night, everyone.
All right.
Good night.
Thank you.